Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Senate passes comprehensive immigration reform, which may double as a stimulus package. And a day after the Supreme Court overturned the Defense of Marriage Act, attention and money shift to the states. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer or mobile device instantly streamed by Netflix to save you time, money, and hassle. Free 30-day trial now at netflix.com/APM.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm David Gura in for Kai Ryssdal, and this is the Marketplace Podcast. It's Thursday, the 27th of June, and it's great to have you with us. The Senate has just passed comprehensive immigration reform legislation by a vote of 68 to 32. Included in that 1,200-page bill is something called The Surge, a proposal to spend nearly $50 billion to beef up security, which will be used to hire more federal agents and to build more fencing. Marketplace's Noel King looks at what that flood of money could mean for the economy along the border.
The security surge could be really good for border areas that are struggling economically, says Chris Wilson of the Wilson Center's Mexico Institute.
Certainly, we know that there will be around 20,000 jobs created in terms of Border Patrol jobs. There's another $7.5 billion in the amendment for more fencing along the border. Somebody has to build those fences. I think there absolutely are opportunities for a type of stimulus to the border region.
But Wilson says added security could also undercut existing economic ties between border cities like Brownsville, Texas, and Matamoros, Mexico. Gilberto Salinas is vice president for the Economic Development Council in Brownsville.
You know, myself, for example, my parents are from, you know, Matamoros. I'm born on the U.S. side, educated on the U.S. side. I'm representative of 90 to 95% of the people in this community that still have family and we still do business on both sides of the river.
Take Ezekiel Silva, who owns S&M Transports, a trucking company in Brownsville. About 80% of his company's revenue comes from trailers that haul office supplies back and forth across the border. While he likes the idea of increased security...
More security means there's more inspections, that means there's more detail, there's more paperwork, which delays the crossing of the product.
Silva says the math is pretty simple. For every minute his drivers spend stuck at a border crossing, his bottom line takes a hit. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
Now that the Supreme Court has weighed in on same-sex marriage, a lot of the focus moves to states. Right now, 13 states and the District of Columbia recognize same-sex marriages. The rest don't. That means married same-sex couples in those other states won't have access to federal marriage benefits unless laws change at the state level. Liberal and conservative groups on both sides of the marriage debate are gearing up for a fight, or 37 fights, actually, in the rest of those states. And that is going to be expensive, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Opponents of same-sex marriage have just lost at the Supreme Court in the six states that approved same-sex marriage in the last year, and they've been losing the fundraising battle. Peter Sprigg is with the Family Research Council.
Our greatest strength is mobilizing people, particularly in the Christian community through churches and so forth. But raising money is a greater challenge for the pro-family movement.
Sprigg says regular churchgoers give to their church first before conservative political campaigns. But the conservatives may get a boost by being the underdog, says Middlebury College political scientist Bert Johnson.
They often feel like they're making a difference if their position is threatened. So I wouldn't be surprised to see the anti-same-sex marriage side doing quite well in fundraising.
As for the other side, the Supreme Court just galvanized its supporters to get the job done all over the country, says Danielle Moody Mills at the Center for American Progress.
You're talking door to door, going around and meeting with legislators, rolling out radio ads and television ads and flyers, and that takes a ton of money.
But with so many hot-button issues out there, marriage, abortion, inequality, could advocates on the same side end up competing for money? Bert Johnson doesn't think so.
People tend to donate based on one particular issue or a small set of issues. I think it's not a zero-sum game. It's more likely to be a positive-sum game.
He says right now, motivated donors are likely to keep taking out their checkbooks again and again. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
John Corzine used to be co-chairman of Goldman Sachs. He's a former senator and a former governor of New Jersey. Today, Corzine was charged for misusing nearly $1 billion of customer money when he was the head of MF Global. That brokerage collapsed in 2011. In its complaint, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC, says Corzine, quote, failed to supervise diligently the activities of MF Global's officers, employees, and agents, unquote. Before the charges were filed, Corzine's people denied any wrongdoing. So there's that. On Wall Street, traders were pretty happy. Details when we do the numbers. Silicon Valley has changed everyday life for Americans and for people around the world. Entrepreneurs there are smart and creative, good at innovation, disrupting old business models. That should make them well-equipped to solve world poverty, too, right? Well, Charles Kenny questions that premise in a piece he co-wrote for Foreign Policy magazine. Charles Kenny, it's good to have you with us.
It's good to be on.
Charles, the title of your piece is Can Silicon Valley Save the World? Can it?
No. It can help make the world a bit of a better place, though.
And tell me how.
Well, there's just a lot more to development than, you know, the latest whiz-bang app on your iPhone. It takes institutional change. It takes building infrastructure. It takes education. It takes, you know, changes in norms and behaviors. So there's a lot more to the story of development than just technology.
Give me a couple examples, if you would, of tools or technology that has been brought to the developing world that maybe didn't work out so well.
Well, in Peru, farmers were so annoyed that money was being spent on internet kiosks rather than irrigation programs, which is what they wanted, that they actually burnt down the internet kiosks. And across large parts of the developing world, we've seen very low usage rates of internet kiosks. Another one we mentioned in the article is the play pump, which sounded like a great idea.
This got a lot of press, I remember.
It did indeed. The idea was that you attached a carousel to a pump. You had kids running around on the carousel and playing away, and then that would pump up water from deep underground. Well, it turned out that in order to sort of meet the demands of a local community, kids would have to play on this pump 27 hours a day. And it is the kind of idea that has that appeal, right? It's kids playing and leading to development, and it's a lovely idea. But we've really got to test these ideas out on the ground, really quite carefully, in order to make sure they work properly.
It seems to me that failure has a different definition in the developing world when you're looking at changing or saving the world than it does, say, if you're making a fitness app or something like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously the costs of failure are higher, right? I mean, there's not very much money in the developing world, and we waste a lot of that money on ideas that sound really cool but actually make no difference. You know, the cost is lost lives. It's not just somebody with a less cool fitness app.
In Silicon Valley, do you think that people have as a goal changing the world, saving the world? Is that an explicit goal that people in Silicon Valley have?
I think we've seen some Silicon Valley entrepreneurs say very explicitly that they've made lots of money and they want to spend some of it on doing good, and they're going to save the world. And, I don't want to knock that. I just say there are better and worse ways of doing it. I mean, if you look at the sort of the Gates Foundation, as it might be, there's a tech entrepreneur who's actually been really quite careful to put his money in tested approaches, things like vaccines, where we know that you can really make a difference to lives and save millions of lives if you do it right. So, you know, there are good and bad ways to do this. And the hope, my hope is that more tech entrepreneurs take that can-do spirit and take their money and use it in effective ways to really make a difference.
Charles Kenny, he and Justin Sandifer co-wrote a piece for Foreign Policy magazine, Can Silicon Valley Save the World? Thanks, Charles.
Thanks very much for having me.
Today, the Department of Agriculture released new regulations on snacks that are sold in vending machines at schools. Companies that make junk food have been offering healthier options, but starting next year, no candy bar or soda or bag of chips in a school vending machine can exceed 200 calories. A look now at the inner life of the school vending machine from Marketplace's David Weinberg.
In the 1940s, Myron Forst saw a man servicing a penny gumball machine. When the man opened up the machine, Forst peeked inside where the coins were collected.
And there was about six dimes in there that people had used as a penny.
At that moment, something clicked in Forrest's mind. All those pennies added up to dollars. By the time he was 16, Forrest had 50 peanut machines. Today, he owns 758 vending machines in Southern California. Lately, he's been getting more requests for healthier items, like baked chips.
A lot of times, we throw away our baked chips because even though the customer has requested it, it does not move and it goes stale on us.
The junk food that people often choose over healthy alternatives are what many nutritionists refer to as competitive foods.
Meaning they compete with healthier foods.
Kevin Concannon is the Undersecretary for Food Nutrition at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He says the smart snacks in schools regulations will prevent kids from having to choose between a candy bar and a banana.
39 states already have some variation of state regulations that governs the foods that are sold in schools.
When the new rules go into effect, every state will have uniform guidelines. Analysts expect the vending machine industry will generate about $7.4 billion next year. Nearly $2 billion of that will come from schools. But here in California, where schools already require healthier vending machines,
you have to put in stuff that the kids don't really want.
Forrest says he's already seen a drop in sales. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
And on the off chance you're curious about what's in our vending machine here, I can guarantee you're not going to find much under 200 calories. We've got a photo up. It's at marketplace.org. Coming up,
the stars are no longer the people themselves, it's the genre.
As the movie industry changes, it may be we've seen the last action hero, or at least the last action hero who can do it all on its own. But first, let's do the numbers. Investors continue to put last week's sell-off in the rearview mirror. The Dow Jones Industrial Average chugged up another 114 points, 0.75%, to close at 15,024. The NASDAQ added 25 points, also 0.75%, to finish at 3,401. And the S&P 500 ticked up 9 points, 0.6%, to end at 1,613. ConAgra packed on 5% gain after the food maker posted better-than-expected earnings. Home builders were strengthened by an upbeat report on the housing market. D.R. Horton climbed 3.8%, and Toll Brothers built a gain of 2.6%. Gold prices dropped another 1.5% and traded under $1,200 an ounce at one point today. That's the first time that's happened in 3 years. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.48%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. Streamed now by Netflix, a great value. Netflix Streaming has lots of movie and television options, including past seasons of House of Cards, Breaking Bad, and Arrested Development. Watch them using Netflix Instant Streaming and find thousands of other TV series and movies during your free 30-day trial at netflix.com/APM.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The University of Michigan releases its final June Consumer Sentiment Survey. Animal advocates are gathered in Washington for the 4-day Animal Rights National Conference. And it's the anniversary of the Stonewall Riots, which began on June 28, 1969 in New York City. Many consider them the start of the gay liberation movement. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdal. Amethyst Lewis is 17. Christian Orellana is 18. They just graduated from high school in New York City, where they spent more than a year on what's a serious public policy problem. Kids skipping school. That's better known as truancy or chronic absenteeism. Amethyst and Christian were members of a project New York State helps run called the Youth Justice Board. They met with students, teachers, and administrators to find out why kids don't show up for class and how to change that. They just presented their findings at City Hall. Hey, guys.
Hello.
So I wanted to ask you about why aren't kids showing up for school regularly?
Well, each kid story is different. It could be that their parents don't speak English and they have to translate for them, or that they don't have a MetroCard to get to school and they live very far, or they're disengaged by their teachers for not helping them in their schoolwork and they're falling back on it.
Christian, do teachers, do administrators, do they get that? Do they get that there are these, you know, many different reasons why kids aren't showing up for class?
I think they do understand it. The problem is you can't just focus on one student. And one student may have multiple reasons. So the problem with that is a teacher would have to focus on everybody's problems, and that can just overwhelm a teacher or the administration.
We don't often think about this as an economic issue, but I mean, one of the effects of chronic absenteeism or truancy is economic.
That is true. A lot of teens today think that school is no big deal and they'll just get a job. But they don't realize that the money they want to make is not easy without an education.
So one part of this is you're bringing these recommendations to the city government. Talk to me a bit about what that was like. You guys went to City Hall and presented your results.
We had recommendations on about how to connect everyday life with school and how students can connect school with life. We also talked about Amethyst can help me with
yeah,
that.
Yeah, go ahead.
We also talked about security procedures with scanning, because more schools in New York City have scanning now with lateness.
You say scanning, those are metal detectors.
Yes. They talked about how scanning was a big deal because of the long lines in front of their school and getting into the building, and they're already late for class, so they feel like, why should I go to class?
Amethyst, Christian, you've been through this process. You've done a report. You've presented that to City Hall. What's next for you guys?
For me, in August, I'm going to start attending Pace University.
Amethyst, how about you? What's next?
Well, actually, on Sunday, I'm leaving for school. I'm doing a summer program. I'm going to Arcadia University. I will major in political science and minor in pre-law.
Amethyst Lewis and Christian Orellana, both members of the Youth Justice Board in New York City. Thanks very much for your time, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you want to read Amethyst and Christian's report, if you want to look at their recommendations, we've got a link up at marketplace.org. Tomorrow is the first anniversary of the Supreme Court's decision to uphold the Affordable Care Act. Healthcare reform has to be fully implemented by January. Ahead of that deadline, the conversation has been pretty wonky about things like global payments, aligned incentives, health data solutions, you know, industry stuff. Well, one artist based in Washington, D.C. wants to make sure patients don't get lost in that conversation. From the health desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
The oncologist stayed back, just outside the hospital room door.
We had a list of 5 questions of what we needed to know was going to happen next.
Regina Holiday had simple questions, like, when's my husband going to get surgery? When's he going to get chemotherapy? When can we get a walker so he can get out of bed?
And the doctor said, don't worry about the questions. We've decided we are sending you home.
Translation? There's nothing more we can do. Holiday's mind raced. One tiny apartment, 2 small kids, one 39-year-old husband dying of kidney cancer. She looked at the doctor, who still hadn't come into the room, and she asked him, how's this all going to work?
That will be a question for the discharge nurse on Monday. And then he left us there.
In that brutal moment, when patient and doctor were so far apart, Regina Holiday felt powerless. And it only got worse over the next several weeks as her husband got sicker. Holiday never felt like she could just break through the system and get a handle on her husband's care.
Well, there's some folks who feel like patients, why can't they just be compliant? If they just listen to their instructions, when really we're not meeting at the same point.
In the time since her husband died, Holiday thinks she's hit on a way to make it easier for patients to be heard.
All week I've been saying, I get my jacket.
For the past 2 years, Holiday has painted people's healthcare stories onto the backs of suit jackets and blazers. Stories of towering hospitals that dominate a grim monopoly board, empowered patient hands reaching up with their smartphones. She calls it the walking gallery.
I'm so excited.
Pat Sauber is an internist and emergency room doctor. Her jacket shows her walking toward an Emerald City, holding her children's hands. It's one of more than 250 that have been painted so far.
Gina, thank you. It's so wonderful.
I have a
walking gallery jacket.
Holiday sets up her easel at healthcare conferences and recruits people by offering the paintings for free. The hope is influential types like policymakers, insurance executives, and doctors will wear these stories on their backs. Stories in vivid paint that will be reminders to make sure patients don't get lost in the rush to fix healthcare or to make money off reforming healthcare. Kavita Patel with the Brookings Institution, who doesn't have a jacket, says the strategy of humanizing people behind controversial issues is smart and effective.
The AIDS quilt and the stories and the images associated with it had a very substantial impact on policymakers. I think that's literally what we're seeing the birth of in her efforts.
The walking gallery is a long way from the AIDS quilt, but Holiday's work has come at a good time. Her campaign has tapped into a growing national discussion.
I think we are in an exciting moment where the balance is shifting, more attention towards patient behavior, patient engagement, patient empowerment.
Dr. Farzad Mostashari helps oversee health technology for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and he has his own jacket painted with an electronic health records theme. He says, look around. Patients are being taken more seriously than ever. Companies are popping up to help consumers shop for insurance, and hospitals can find their fortunes tied to patient surveys. Some think focusing on patients has enough momentum. It doesn't need what some consider a gimmicky approach, though that sentiment doesn't slow down Holiday.
Give me the human face and give me the human story, and now we can do magic together.
Holiday says she's out recruiting walkers and looking for other artists, too. As they like to say in healthcare circles, Holiday wants to scale up this project. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
To see some of Holiday's creations, you can check them out, marketplace.org. It's summer, which means it's movie season. What promises to be a big blockbuster comes to theaters this weekend, an action movie called White House Down.
This is John Cale. I'm with the president. We're in the White House. They've taken the building and they're holding hostages, including my daughter.
Help is not coming. You just need to get out of there.
Can you not hit me in the head with a rocket while I'm trying to drive?
Oh, boy. Watching that trailer, I couldn't help but think of something Wesley Morris said on the show a few months back about the action hero. Wesley Morris is a film critic at Grantland. Hey, Wesley.
Hey, David. How are you?
I'm good. All right. So this weekend, White House Down opens, starring Channing Tatum. And Wesley, you were on the show a few months back talking about Bruce Willis, I believe, a man who, like the rest of us, keeps getting older and older, but unlike the rest of us, is still an action star. So I wonder, is Channing Tatum, do you think Bruce Willis's heir apparent here? Is he the new action hero?
No, I don't think the model really holds anymore. And I think what's actually happening is you have these team-ups happening, where you have either large ensembles, the Star Trek movies or Fast and Furious movies, or you have a team-up like White House Down, which is actually a Jamie Foxx, Channing Tatum movie, or The Heat, which also opens on Friday, which has Sandra Bullock and Melissa McCarthy. And you have fewer and fewer movies that place these things on the shoulders of one individual, one star.
Why is that happening, Wesley? Why can one man or one woman no longer shoulder a franchise, an action franchise?
Well, I mean, in some ways, the way the movie business has gone, you don't need stars in the... I mean, the thinking is that you don't need stars in the way that you used to. The stars are no longer the people themselves, it's the genre. So, you know, like the zombie movie or the vampire movie or the superhero movie, these things are sort of the attractions now. You could put anybody in these movies and people will still go is the assumption.
You know, you talk about putting anybody in these movies and even in an action movie like White House Down, you've got Channing Tatum paired with Jamie Foxx. I mean, these are sort of unexpected pairings.
Right. Well, I mean, it's got to be smart, too. I mean, I think the thing about a movie like The Heat is you have Melissa McCarthy and Sandra Bullock, two people who America likes individually working together.
But don't scream action star to me, those two.
Right. Yeah, so, I mean, you have an action comedy starring these two people. I think that the reason that movie will probably be a hit is because there are two people with a proven track record doing this particular kind of thing. And I think the thing about what you're seeing now with a movie like World War Z, which is this zombie movie that opened last week that stars Brad Pitt.
Yeah, this seems to poke a little hole in your theory there, because here's an action movie, a very expensive action movie that has one star, perhaps the star with a capital V. That's Brad Pitt.
Well, yes and no. I mean, if it were Brad Pitt doing something besides fighting zombies, I'd be more open to that argument. But I mean, you have a built-in hook. I think Brad Pitt is like extra. He's a bonus. You could have taken Channing Tatum and put him in that movie, and it would, you know what I mean? It's like, with all due respect to Channing Tatum, I think, of course. The point is, it's easier to sell something like zombies or vampires because there's a built-in audience for that sort of thing in a different way than there's an assumed built-in audience for a guy like Brad Pitt. And I think this is how you wind up with a movie like The Avengers, which is just laden with stars, but the stars aren't the attraction. It's the comic book itself.
Wesley Morris, film critic for Grantland. Thanks, Wesley.
Thank you, David.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, you can look forward to the first conversation between a human and a robot in space. That's right, it's really happening. This fall, a humanoid communication robot called Kirobo will travel to the International Space Station. He, or she, or it, is about a foot tall. Kirobo speaks Japanese. Its mission is to keep astronauts company. What's the Japanese for just what do you think you're doing, Dave? Hey, it can get lonely out there. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 114 points, 0.75%. The NASDAQ added 25 points, also 0.75%. And the S&P 500 climbed 9 points, 0.6%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm David Gura. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.